You know that feeling, that moment where you're just so certain about something, maybe a path you're taking or a belief you hold really deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe slowly, maybe suddenly, people around you start drifting away. Your friends, people you trusted,
yeah,
they don't agree. Maybe they don't even get it. And your own confidence just starts to wobble. Has that ever happened to you where your circle shrinks because of what you believe and you start questioning, well, everything?
Oh, absolutely. That's a really common and frankly pretty tough human experience, feeling isolated because your convictions put you on the outer. It can definitely shake your confidence.
It really can. So today we're doing a deep dive into a specific passage, John chapter 6, verses 60 to 71.
Okay.
And we're looking at it through the lens of a modern sermon from Dwell City Church that explores this very passage.
Gotcha.
Our whole mission here is to pull out some insights, some powerful ways to hold on to your confidence in what you believe, even when you hit setbacks, rejection, or as the sermon calls it, a kind of mass exodus.
Right, when people you thought were right there with you start leaving.
Exactly.
And it's probably good to remember, we touched on this last time, Jesus as the bread of life,
mm-hmm.
how he nourishes and sustains. That whole discussion really sets the stage for this next part, which is, well, a major challenge to people's faith.
Yeah, it flows right into it. So the big question we're trying to unpack today is, when people leave, when your beliefs face opposition, how do you stop your confidence from just evaporating?
How do you stand firm?
Exactly. And we're going to look at three powerful ways the source material suggests we can do just that.
Okay, sounds good. Where do we start?
Okay, first big idea, expect the offense. Oh, this sounds a bit blunt, maybe.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
But necessary, perhaps.
The sermon really zooms in on Jesus' teaching here. That incredibly challenging idea of eating his flesh and drinking his blood for eternal life.
Which, understandably, was just really hard for people to grasp. It led directly to that question, this is a hard saying, who can listen to it?
Right. And what's fascinating is how the sermon points out that so many core biblical ideas are actually counterintuitive.
Yeah.
They sort of push against common sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, think about those paradoxes mentioned, like the way down is the way up.
Or to be low is to be high.
A broken heart is a healed heart. To give is to receive.
To bear the cross is to wear the crown.
Mm-hmm.
They sound poetic, but they're deeply challenging concepts, right?
Yeah.
They go against the grain of how we usually think things work.
Exactly. And that's why they are hard sayings. They're difficult to accept on multiple levels.
And the sermon actually breaks that difficulty down into like three layers, which I found really helpful.
Yeah.
First, there's just basic conceptual understanding, you know, the initial confusion. Like mistaking something spiritual for something physical.
Like the eating and drinking thing. People heard it literally, physically.
Exactly. But Jesus was speaking spiritually. So that's hurdle number one, just getting what's actually being said.
Right. Then comes the second layer, agreement with the truth. So maybe you understand it conceptually. You get what's being said.
Okay.
Let's say, okay, I understand the Bible says God requires moral perfection. But you might just disagree. You might think, yeah, I get that's the claim, but I don't buy it. I think God's probably more lenient.
So understanding it isn't the same as agreeing with it.
Not at all. And then there's this third layer, which the sermon called gladness about the truth.
Gladness.
Yeah. Even if you understand it, and maybe you even agree it's true, you might still not like it. You might feel deep down, ugh, I wish that wasn't the case.
That makes sense. Like, accepting something intellectually versus embracing it emotionally or volitionally.
Precisely. True acceptance, the sermon argues, involves all three.
Uh-huh.
Understanding, agreement, and this gladness of heart about it.
Okay, so these truths can be hard on multiple levels. What's the temptation then?
Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? The temptation is to water it down.
Make it easier to swallow.
Yeah, make it more palatable. Or just, you know, skip over the hard parts altogether. Conveniently ignore the bits that cause friction.
But the sermon delivers a really stark warning there. It says, if you avoid the offense, you abandon the truth.
Wow, that's direct.
It is.
Yeah.
So bringing this back to confidence, how does expecting offense help?
Well, the logic is pretty straightforward. If you know going in that these core convictions might cause offense, might lead to ejection,
then it's not such a shock when it happens.
Exactly. You're less likely to have your confidence completely shattered because on some level you anticipated it. It doesn't feel like a personal failure necessarily, but more like, okay, this is part of what happens when you hold these truths.
It reframes the rejection.
It does. And this connects really well to that classic psychology experiment, the Solomon-Ashline experiment.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about that.
Okay, so imagine this. You walk into a room. On one board, there's a single line. On another board, there are three lines labeled A, B, and C.
Simple enough.
Your job is just to say which line, A, B, or C, is the same length as the single line on the first board. It's usually pretty obvious, but here's the twist. Everyone else in the room answers before you do. And unbeknownst to you, they're all actors or plants.
Uh-oh.
And they've all been told to give the wrong answer. Consistently.
So they all pick a line that's clearly shorter or longer.
Exactly. And Ash found that something like 9 out of 10 times, the real participant, the one who doesn't know about the setup,
goes along with the crowd.
Yep. They conform to the group's wrong answer. Even though their own eyes are telling them something different, the pressure seeing everyone else agree on the wrong thing makes them doubt their own judgment. Their confidence just crumbles.
Wow. That's powerful. And you can totally see the parallel to the disciples, right? Seeing others walk away.
Yeah.
It makes you think, wait, am I the one who's wrong?
Precisely. It highlights that social pressure, that fear of being the odd one out. But the Bible actually prepares us for this offense.
How so?
Well, think about 1 Corinthians 1:18. It says, for the word of the cross is folly or foolishness to those who are perishing.
So what seems true and life-giving to one person seems nonsensical to another.
Exactly. And then 1 Corinthians 2:14 adds that the natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, because they are spiritually discerned. It's saying there's a fundamental difference in perception.
So it's not just disagreement. It's almost like inability to see it the same way without that spiritual element.
That's the idea presented. And the Bible even calls Jesus himself a rock of offense and a stumbling stone. So if Jesus himself is described that way, we probably shouldn't be surprised if the things he taught also cause offense.
Okay, so step one, expect it. Don't be blindsided by the offense. Now, the second point gets into the how of belief. It's titled, A Behind-the-Scenes Look at the Process of Belief.
Right. This section dives into how spiritual belief actually happens, according to Jesus' words here.
Jesus draws this contrast, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Between the flesh-like, our physical eyes, what we can see, and the spirit, our spiritual understanding.
He does. He poses this question, basically asking, what if you were to see me, the Son of Man, ascending back to where I was before? It's like he's asking, would seeing that miracle be enough to convince you?
Challenging that whole seeing is believing idea.
Directly. Because his answer is pretty stark. It is the spirit who gives life. The flesh is no help at all.
So just witnessing a miracle, even something as amazing as the ascension, isn't guaranteed to produce faith.
Apparently not, according to this. Physical evidence alone, the flesh, doesn't automatically generate that spiritual life or understanding. It takes the spirit.
The sermon used a really neat analogy here, didn't it, with a watch?
Oh, yeah. That was helpful. Imagine you find an old analog watch on a beach. You've never seen one.
Okay.
Over time, you notice the hands seem to move with the sun, maybe correspond to day and night. You suspect it tells time, but you're not really confident. You don't know how it works.
Right. It's just a guess based on observation.
But then a watchmaker comes along, opens up the back, shows you all the intricate gears, the springs, the design, explains how it all works together precisely to keep time.
Ah, okay. Seeing the inner workings.
Exactly. That behind the scenes look, understanding the mechanism, gives you real confidence that yes, this thing actually works. It reliably tells time.
And the analogy is that understanding the process of belief gives us more confidence in it.
That's the idea. Seeing how spiritual life comes about, according to Jesus, bolsters our confidence in the reality of it.
And Jesus connects us directly to his words, right?
He does. He says, the words that I have spoken to you are spirit and life. It's not just that his words are about spiritual things.
They are the means.
They are presented as the very means by which the spirit brings about that life.
Mm.
But it's not automatic for everyone who hears, which leads to this kind of intriguing secret that's revealed.
What's that?
Well, the text says Jesus knew from the beginning who wouldn't believe and even who would betray him.
He knew all along. Judas, the others who left.
He knew. But here's the kicker. He never told the disciples. He never pointed someone out and said, don't bother with that guy. He's not going to get it. Or watch out for him. He's going to betray me.
That is surprising. Why wouldn't he? Why not streamline things for his followers if he knew the outcome? Seems inefficient almost.
Well, the sermon suggests some really profound reasons for the secrecy. Three main ones.
Okay.
First, it demonstrates the sheer magnitude of God's love. A love that keeps reaching out even to enemies, even to those he knows will reject him. It teaches us something about loving those who oppose us.
Okay, that's powerful. What's the second?
Second, It highlights the value of relationships over tasks. It shows that people are important in themselves, not just for what they can do or whether they'll eventually believe.
So it's not transactional, like I'll invest in you if you convert.
Exactly. It's relational. God isn't presented as just a, you know, a cosmic problem solver or a genie, but as someone to be known intimately, regardless of the outcome.
And the third reason?
It keeps us humble and dependent on God. If we knew who would or wouldn't believe, we might rely on our own discernment, maybe get prideful, or give up on people too easily. This way, we have to rely on God's work, not our insight.
That makes a lot of sense. It prevents us from playing God, in a way.
Mm-hmm. And this all builds towards another critical statement from Jesus. No one can come to me unless it is granted him by the Father.
Ah, so belief isn't just our choice or effort.
It's presented here as fundamentally a gift, something initiated and enabled by God the Father. Paul echoes this elsewhere, saying faith is the gift of God, not a result of works.
So we have a role, planting, watering, sharing the words, but the actual life, the increase, comes from God.
That's the picture painted here. It brings life out of what is spiritually dead.
And thinking about the watchmaker analogy again, this understanding of the Father granting Jesus' words being spirit and life, the spirit working. It's like seeing the gears mesh, isn't it?
It really is. The sermon talked about this as the inseparable operations of the Trinity. The Father acts through the Word, Jesus, by the Spirit, to bring about this spiritual life. Mm-hmm. Understanding that divine collaboration, that behind-the-scenes process.
It really boosts your confidence that this whole thing is real and has a divine power behind it.
Exactly. It's not just resting on our feelings or circumstances.
Okay, so we've got expect the offense and understand the divine process behind belief. What's the third pillar for maintaining confidence?
The third one is this profound affirmation that he has it all planned out.
Planned out. Even the bad stuff.
Well, let's look at what happens next in the story. After Jesus' hard sayings, the text is blunt. Many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him.
The mass exodus we talked about earlier.
The mass exodus.
Yeah.
And the source suggests these were likely people who were initially drawn in for maybe more superficial or physical reasons.
Like the miracles, the free food,
yeah,
the loaves and fishes.
Right. Not necessarily deep spiritual conviction. So when the teaching got hard, they were out.
Okay, so lots of people leave. Then what?
Then Jesus turns to the inner circle, the 12 apostles, and he asks them point blank, do you want to go away as well?
Wow. That's intense. It's like the ASH experiment in reverse almost. The crowd is leaving. Will you follow them or will you stand firm?
Exactly. It's a moment of truth. And Simon Peter steps up with this incredible response.
What does he say?
He says, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God.
That's a powerful declaration of confidence.
It really is. The sermon emphasizes this. Those who have been given that spiritual life, who truly see Jesus for who he is, they recognize there's nowhere else to turn. They see the unique truth and beauty in him.
Even when things get tough, even when others leave.
Even then. But then, right after this amazing confession of faith, Jesus drops another bombshell.
What now?
He says, did I not choose you, the 12, and yet one of you is a devil?
Whoa. He's talking about Judas.
He's talking about Judas Iscariot. Right there, in the inner circle, one of the handpicked 12 is going to betray him, and Jesus knows it.
That's staggering. Betrayal from the inside. How does that relate to confidence? It seems like it would shatter it.
You'd think so. But here's the paradox the sermon highlights. Jesus chose Judas, knowing from the beginning what he would do.
He chose his own betrayer, intentionally.
The text implies it, which suggests something really profound, that even the setbacks, the struggles, the betrayals were somehow part of the plan from the very beginning.
That's a hard idea to wrap your head around, that God's plan might include such difficult, painful things.
It absolutely is. And that's where the sermon brings in another analogy, the African safari.
Okay, how does that work?
Imagine you're going on a dangerous safari. To be safe, you don't need a detailed map of every single quicksand pit, every tiger den, every hidden snake burrow.
Well, you'd be paralyzed trying to track all that.
What you really need is a trustworthy guide, someone who does know the terrain, who knows where the dangers are, who has navigated it before.
You need to stick close to the guide.
Exactly. You trust the guide, not your own limited knowledge of the dangers.
And the connection is, we don't need to know every detail of the trouble ahead in our lives.
That's the application. We don't need to know who might betray us or what hardship is around the corner. We just need to be with the guide, with Jesus, who does know all the details.
The one who has the whole plan.
Yes. The one who knows the end from the beginning and whose plan is ultimately working towards good, even if it involves leading us through storms or allowing betrayals as part of that plan.
So the confidence comes not from knowing the details of the hardship, but from knowing who is in control of the plan.
Precisely. Trusting the guide, even when the path seems confusing or dangerous. Knowing that even the difficult parts are not random, but somehow foreseen and incorporated into his larger purpose. That's a deep source of confidence.
Wow. Okay, that really reframes challenges and setbacks. It doesn't make them less painful, maybe, but it gives them a different context.
A purposeful context, yeah.
Yeah. So let's just quickly recap those three big ideas for staying confident when facing rejection or setbacks.
Okay.
First, expect the offense. Remember that pushback and misunderstanding are often part of the deal when dealing with counterintuitive truths.
Right. Don't be surprised by it. Second, get that behind the scenes. Look at belief. Understand that it's fundamentally a spiritual process, a gift initiated by God involving the Father, Son, and Spirit. It's not just about physical sight or human effort.
Which gives you confidence in the process itself. And third, the affirmation that he has it all planned out. Trusting the guide who knows the whole journey, even the difficult parts, the betrayals, the storms.
Knowing it's all part of a larger sovereign plan provides a deep anchor.
So we've really dug into how these ancient words, viewed through this modern sermon, offer some practical ways to shore up our confidence. It really makes you think, doesn't it, about your own journey with beliefs and convictions.
Definitely. Maybe you can reflect on what hard sayings or counterintuitive truths you've bumped up against in your own life or in your own thinking.
Yeah. And maybe chew on this a bit as we finish. How does really grasping this process of belief, seeing it as a spiritual gift, divinely orchestrated, how does that change things?
Or how does knowing that even the really tough stuff, the challenges, the rejections, might actually be woven into a larger, purposeful plan? How does that shift how you face uncertainty?
How does it impact your perspective on sticking to your convictions when maybe the crowd starts to thin out around you? There's nothing about it.